This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 55 of What's It Like. My guest is Jack Angel, which sounds like such a nice name. Were you born with that name?
I was.
Really?
Yeah.
That's surprising to me. Someone in media with a real name.
Yeah. Well, it was a cool name, so I just kept it. But, I mean, as far as show business is concerned, my father was from Crete, and his name was Yanni Angelakis.
Ah.
Got here and got his citizenship papers. He changed it to Angel.
Americanized it.
Yeah, and he's the original Johnny Angel. I'm really John Jr., but to differentiate between the two, they called me Jack.
Where did you grow up?
Berkeley.
Berkeley?
Yeah.
That's a nice area.
It is. It's great. I loved it.
Did you go to school there, too?
I went to Berkeley High School.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be an artist, but somewhere along 11th grade, I discovered girls. I mean, really heavy into discovering girls. And the guys I hung with were not the brightest guys in the world. And my grades went to hell. But anyway, when I got out of high school, I went to the California College of Arts and Crafts in Oakland to apply to be an art student. And they turned me down. I said, "What do you mean? Why?" And they said, "Because you don't have grades." And I said, "This is an art school." And they said, "No, you got to have a modicum of intelligence." So they changed my life in that moment. Because had I gone to the California College of Arts and Crafts, I'd be a little old man sitting there drawing stuff all my life.
So you had to find something else to do.
Yeah.
So what led you to radio?
Well, I had a pretty good voice, for one thing. And I went in the Army. I wanted to get away from stuff that was going on in my family. And it was during the Korean War. I mean, here's how bright I was. I joined the Army during a war. But I went through basic training at Fort Ord and went to leadership school and taught physical training at leadership school for 6 months, and then went to officer candidate school and became a second lieutenant. And then got my orders to go to Korea, and the war was still on. So I decided, oh, I need more training. I don't want to go over there and get my ass shot off. So I applied for Ranger School, and they accepted me, and I went to Ranger School and almost became an Army Ranger. But there's a little imp inside of me that necessarily needs to mouth off every once in a while. And I mouthed off to a major and found myself on a bus out of there in 7 of the 8 weeks. So I got the training, but I didn't get the Ranger arc. Anyway, I did go to Korea, but in the meantime, in the interim, the war was over. So I thought, well, this is kind of now it's just a trip, right? So I should tell you this interesting little story. Right after I got out of high school, I got a job with a local commercial artist. My art teacher taught him, and she thought I was pretty good, so I got this scut boy job. And I had to make signs, big metal signs that were, I don't know, three feet long, I guess, and about a foot wide. And I had a silk screen white paint on these metal signs, and they cut my hands, and I was miserable. And there was thousands of them. And I had to put them in these drying racks. And when it was done, I thought, God, I'm done with these things. And he said, no. Now you have to silk screen in red, "Mine's Danger," on these signs. So I had to do them all again. When it was all done, I quit that job and vowed never to ever silk screen anything again. So cut to several years later, I get to Korea, and the Army won't let you stand still. They want to make you train and do all that crap. So I became an umpire on the war games. And so we were looking for places to play the games, and rice paddies were in plentiful supply. But as we're driving down the road, I saw these signs that said, "Mine's Danger." Oh, those are my signs. I hated those things. Ironically, because I was pulled out of my company to be an umpire, a wonderful young guy named Keith O'Connor, another second lieutenant, handsome, he was the perfect all-American boy. He took over my platoon, and they were practicing in this rice paddy that they thought had been cleared of mines. And he stepped on one, and a young officer from I Corps waded through that minefield. And actually, when he stepped on the mine, it hit him and his sergeant. They were both down, and the doctor walked through the minefield, knelt down next to O'Connor, and his knee hit another mine and blew all three of them up.
Oh, my goodness.
So the absence of the mine clearing process, led to the death of these guys. And I always thought, I must have a protector up there somewhere, because that was my platoon. I probably would have been the guy, in that situation.
Yeah. So when you were growing up, did you come from a large family?
No, I had two brothers, one older, one younger, and a crazy mother. I guess everybody had kind of a crazy mother, but mine was particularly nuts. Lovingly nuts.
So who had the biggest influence on your life growing up?
She did. Although I have recently written an autobiography, and it was my father, when he came from Greece, he had heard the metaphor that the streets of America are paved with gold, and he took it literally when he got off the boat. He looked down and said, where the hell is gold, Well, he wound up in a coal mine in Pennsylvania for a while and socked his money away and came to Central California, the San Joaquin Valley, and he had a bean ranch. And he used to say, I was the bean king. And, when you're little, you go, boy, my dad was the bean king. And then when you get older, you realize your parents have a tendency to stretch the truth a little bit, and you begin to not believe anything they ever told you. So here I am. I'm breaking into radio in Merced, which is the county seat of where he got his citizenship papers. And I was smoked in those days, and I stopped by to get a pack of cigarettes in this store, and these people in there were talking Greek. And although I don't really speak Greek, I knew enough to know that that's what they were saying. So I said, Tikanis. And they say, Kalafausto, you Greek? And I said, yeah. I said, as a matter of fact, my father got his citizenship papers here 30 years ago. And an old man in the back said, who's your father? And I said, John Angel. He said, John Angel? The Bean King? He really was the Bean King.
So you come from royalty.
Royalty, yes.
What was your major challenge as a child?
I don't know. I had a great childhood. But that was back in the days when everybody left the door open. You could play outside way after dark. You could walk around the neighborhood and nobody seemed to bother you. It was a much safer time, particularly in a town like Berkeley.
Yeah, it was. Well, Berkeley was a small town in that era.
Yeah, right. Its reason for existence was that it was right next to the University of California, which was the big edifice up there. Everybody go to Cal, except stupid people like me. I wound up, by the way, getting my degree at San Francisco State, which was a pretty cool school too.
What was your degree in?
Radio and television production.
Mm-hmm. So, how long were you in radio?
18 years. I was a disc jockey, and I started off in Merced, as I said, and I moved from there to Santa Rosa, and from Santa Rosa to San Francisco, from San Francisco to Reno, from Reno to Portland, Oregon, and then down to L.A. For my last 7 years, and ultimately out of radio and just doing voiceovers.
So when you were doing radio, did they have it was the era of the large long play records and the turntables.
Yeah, well, it was the era of personality radio, personalities on the radio. But you've been in, how long have you been in L.A.?
25 years.
Okay, well then, let's see, I've been out of radio for 30. So you came from Seattle?
Yes.
the old KVI in Seattle. Do you remember KVI?
Yes, I worked there. My first job was in radio.
Well, that was the sister station. It was KVI, KEX in Portland, KSFO in San Francisco, and KMPC here. They all had basically the same format. You had Hardwick up there as the morning man. We had Whitting Hill down here. There's Don Sherwood in San Francisco and Barney Keep in Portland. They were the key guys. And but the whole format was based on Sinatra-type music as opposed to heavy rock and roll or country. Mm-hmm. We fringed out on all that stuff. And ball games. We had baseball. Everybody had baseball and football. And really good, top-notch personalities who were given the freedom to do jokes and funny voices and bring stuff to their programs. One of the things that inspired me even more was when I was in Portland. I went on vacation in 1967, and my ex-wife was from Maine, and so she took the children to Maine, and I flew back a month or so later and drove the family back. And I had an opportunity to hear the legends of broadcasting in New York and Boston and Philadelphia and WGN in Chicago. And what I realized was that on my worst day, I brought more to the table than the legends did on their shows. This is and that was and the time. And I was stunned. You know, I was like, these guys they're legendary for what? And apparently it had a psychological effect on me, because after I got back to Portland, my program director came in about a week or so later and he said, "What the hell happened to you on vacation?" I said, "Why?" He said, "You've never sounded so good." And I said, "Oh, well, I heard the legends and they're nothing. And by the way, I'm leaving. I'm going to go to LA, which is where I've always wanted to be anyway." So I started a campaign to come to KMPC, started the campaign in October, and by February 1st, I was there. I did that. Did you ever hear of a guy, Claude Bristol, wrote a book called The Magic of Believing?
Yes.
Well, that was a book that apparently had inspired Phyllis Diller, and so when I heard that, I bought the book, and I read part of it. And part of what he said was to visualize yourself in whatever situation you want to get into. And I wrote KMPC Los Angeles everywhere, you know, on my dashboard, and even at the radio station, and at my place at the table where I shaved and on the mirror, and visualized myself. And you say, "This is Jack Angel from KMPC Los Angeles." And so I visualized myself in the situation, and I began to promote myself to get there. And ultimately, I did.
And when you got there, was it what you expected?
Well, you know, it was and it wasn't. I was the all-night guy. I didn't want to be the all-night guy, but they convinced me that there were more people listening to KMPC in the all-night show than there were listening to Portland in the drive time show. And I thought, well, that's okay. And they promised that when there was an opening, I would move up, which the program director that promised that had long since disappeared by the time there was an opening. So I was getting stuck on the all-night show. So, and I fell out of love with them and moved over to KFI for a while until they fired me a couple of times.
Well, being in radio, no one ever said was a constant job.
No. Well, I got fired from KMPC. I asked to get fired from KMPC because they wouldn't move me off the all-night show. And I got fired from KFI under two different sets of management. And I say it's because I was an incorrigible, which really means that over the years prior to my getting to LA, I really paid attention and learned how to run a radio station, at least the broadcast part, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's okay for you to know more than the people who are running the station, but when you tell them all the time, you're around. And I think the rule of the universe is, when it's my turn to be boss, if you won't let me be boss, you can't play. So they kicked me out a lot, which was okay, because by the time I really got out of radio, it had ceased to be fun. And my motto has always been, life is a game, and therefore, if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. So the other one was, I had a counselor at San Francisco State who said, when I said, I'm coming back for my master's, he said, why? And I said, because if I don't make it as an actor, I can always teach. And he said, then my advice is don't come back for the master's. And I said, why? He says, because you'll have that as an ace in the hole. And every time something comes up that's tough, you'll say, screw it, I can always teach. And you'll be a lousy actor and a lousy teacher. He said, run with the hounds nipping at your heels. So I've been kind of doing that for the last however many years.
How did you get into voiceover?
Well, that's a natural progression from radio is voiceover. A disc jockey.
Yeah.
In job one, I was called upon to create commercials. My ex-wife had just given birth to our first kid, and I wrote a commercial for Gallagher Cleaners in Merced, and she and I doing a two-voice thing, and in the middle of doing the commercial, the baby started crying. So nurse her, and she said, okay. So she's sitting there holding the baby by the microphone and reading the words, and in the middle of the commercial, you're... So I played the spot for the guy who bought it, and I said, he loved it. I said, well, listen again, and he heard the shirt, and he laughed. He said, that's funny, play it.
Well, isn't that nice? Good for them.
So they got out of here when she was like 2 weeks old, a week old.
So how do you typically get a job now? Does somebody call you up and say, hey, we're looking for you, or do you have to audition? How does it work?
Well, I have an agent who just happens to be my wife, but that's really immaterial, sort of. So the way it works now is they send an email to the agent, or they call. Mostly it's done by email. And they say, we're looking for this kind of a voice for this kind of a product, and these are the specs, and here's the copy. So now... a lot of it's done. I have a microphone here. See this? This is my trusty blue microphone. It plugs into my computer. And I have on my PC over here, I have SoundForge. So I record into SoundForge, which automatically converts the thing into an MP3. And I email it to my agent. They futz with it and put it in a package and email it back to the advertising agency, and it's all done like that. And if they like me, they hire me, and if they don't, we move on.
And when they hire you, then you go to a studio to do the work?
Yeah. And every once in a while, they'll take the audition, but that's rare.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go into a studio and flog it for a while, and until sometimes they're in Chicago, and we're on a phone patch. And so there are more takes, and they flog it more when they're not actually in the studio because they want to make sure they got everything. So even when that's done locally, they come in with an entourage. There's the writer and the producer and the director and sometimes the client, and there's the engineer. And I always say you do at least one extra take for every person in the booth. Because everybody has an opinion. And so they say, well, you know, when he said the word interesting, he kind of slurred over it. You know, okay, do it again. So it becomes a camel. You know, the camel is the animal built by committee.
What's the best thing about your job?
Oh, well, there's no work involved. As you know, from having been in radio, you go in and you say stuff and they give you money. What could be better than that?
Well, they didn't give me much money. I was very young and stupid, and it didn't take long for me to decide, you know, psychology sounds like a really good place to be.
Yeah. I always wonder about people who major in psychology, unless you want to be a psychology professor or you open a psychology store and, you know, and people come in, oh, I'd like some psychology. Okay, here.
Well, there's a lot of researchers too. So you get research, you get therapy, you get teaching. There's a broad range of things.
Yeah. No, I don't know of any psychologist that ever got rich. Maybe Dr. Phil.
I would guess that he would qualify as being rich.
He always struck me as kind of a fraud, but
well, yeah, we'll edit this part out. What's the worst thing about your job?
No, I don't know. There's no, well, out there, the worst thing is, and I turn these things down now. A lot of the stuff now are video games, and they're all war, and they're all screaming and yelling, "Fire! Come! Hey, come!" And after a while, you go home and gargle to see if your neck leaks, because it just rips your throat out. When I was younger, I used to laugh at the old guys who said, "I'm going to go down there and do that and tear my throat up." But now I'm the old guy, and they're relentless. The directors don't care that you have a career. They only care about their show. And if they rip your throat out, having you do take after take of some stupid line, gee, that's too bad. And the actors have to be kind of personal self-editors. And I tell them, don't go in there and do that over and over. Tell them no. Say, you've already got it. And if that's not good enough, hire somebody else. It's not worth it to rip your throat out and permanently screw it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was a disc jockey, there's a lot of phlegm and crap in my throat now. But when I was in radio, which was 30-some-odd years ago, there was none of that. It was this pure, really rich-sounding voice. But over the years of yelling and screaming, I mean, I spent 2 days on a Disney soundstage when we did the Hunchback of Notre Dame, because in 2 days, Paris was burning. And we had to scream and yell, you know, the fire, my hair is on fire, you know, all that crazy crap. And it was all background noise, but we had to scream and yell for 2 days.
Wow.
You know, and that's for Schlugener, you know?
Yeah. What type of person would be good at your job?
Oh, I would say anybody can do it. Well, yeah, well, you know, there's a thing. I every once in a while I get the idea that I taught this voiceover for a while. I wrote a book called How to Succeed in Voiceovers Without Ever Losing. And it was more of a context book, how to hold the whole process. One of the things that people believe is that, and they all say it, even Oprah said, "Oh, I don't know how you stand the rejection." And, I mean, I'm sure you've heard that, and maybe you've told people who want to be an actor, there's a lot of rejection. Well, there isn't. It's a big lie. But the truth is that that's not the game. The game is, when I go into audition, they're in the process of finding somebody to work on their show or their spot or whatever it is. And they have an idea of what they want. Let's say that you and I are the producers and we want to hire Santa Claus. So we call the agents and they send us 10 of these big fat guys with beards and go, "Ho, ho, ho, Merry Christmas," right? So now you and I, we look at all of them. We have them all laugh and we chuckle and we see if they have this round little red nose. And we like the beard and all that stuff. And we can hire only one, so we do. We hire one. If the other, let's say 10 guys, the other 9 guys go out and say, "I got rejected." No. When the process started and we're playing here at world class, the quest that went out was send me the best world-class Santa Clauses you have. Validation right there. No rejection. They come in, and unless they're surly, nasty, or drunk, we treat them all equally. We give them all a shot. And it's up to us to pick the one that fits what we want best of all. So our process is selection, not rejection. So we select one. If the rest of them go away and say, "I got rejected," they made it up. And they tell that to other younger actors, and the actors, "Oh, the rejection is terrible. It's awful." No, it doesn't even exist. And yet the business is fraught with all these people who say, "Oh, the rejection is terrible." And it scares the crap out of young people.
Well, the selection is slim.
Well, yeah.
Might be the better way to put it. Yeah.
You know, but everybody has a ratio of you audition 10 times or 20 times or 100 times, and you get one. Okay, so that's your ratio. Now, one time, the last time I got fired from KFI, so I got fired from there twice, it was devastating. I didn't see it coming, and I should have, because I'd set it up a year earlier, but by being incorrigible. But what happened was, I said, well, I'd already blown myself out at two other radio stations in town. I didn't want to leave town. I didn't want to go try to get a job at a rock and roll station because I hated what they were doing. So I thought, well, I'll just concentrate on doing voiceovers, which I did. And 2 years later, I heard me say, am I glad they fired me? Because now I was making twice as much money as I've ever made in radio. I didn't have to go to meetings and have some jerk who could never do it tell me I was doing it wrong. I got all the holidays and weekends off, and I was living. That was great. But when I said that, I said, oh, wait, that was the worst thing that ever happened. Transformed to the best thing that ever happened. Now, here's the line here. Right in the middle is the dividing line. All this crap is the bad stuff, and all this is the good stuff. If the worst thing transformed to the best thing, then all the other stuff on this side of the line also had to help get me to that moment. And I had just never validated the experience. So the game I played with me was to roll the videotape in my head and go to a person, place, thing, event, or whatever, that I held negatively, and find three ways that that event helped get me to now. I always found three. I just wanted to overrule the one negative by having three positives. And I did for about a year. I almost killed myself driving around, rolling the videotape in my head, and then sometimes I would laugh at how stupid I was to try to undermine my, because it was all me, undermining myself. But how cleverly I did it. And one time I'm driving on the freeway and I started laughing. And when I laughed, my eyes closed. And a guy in front slammed on the brakes. And I said, oh no, not now. I almost died. But I was able to stop, okay. But my conclusion was, there are no negatives. There are just events. And we classify them in the moment, whether they serve our momentary purpose or not. That doesn't mean that if you punch me in the mouth, that isn't going to be a negative. But there's also a lesson of why did you do that? You know, how did I set that up? And do you want to continue doing that and keep getting punched in the mouth or not? And there's a lesson to be learned. So if you get the lesson, then it's not a negative, it's a positive, because you got it. I've changed it. That was a seminal moment for me. But the moment that I met my second wife, the one that I'm with now, that's really the key moment of everything. Watch this. Everything I ever did and everything I never did brought me to the moment when I met her. Change one thing, and the path goes this way, and I would have missed her. So all that stuff that, oh, if I could have only had that job, but I didn't get it. No, that is perfect that I didn't get it, because by being not getting that job, I got her.
So how would someone get a job like yours? If I decide I want to do voiceovers, do I have to have a deep voice or a particular style?
Listen to the voices on The Simpsons. They're all different. They're all crazy. Or you know, there's a thousand different voices out there on television. All of them different. Some of them are the Centaurian announcers, and some of them are old farts. You know, I just happen to be able to do most of those voices. But you don't have to do that. You can have one voice. There was a story of the late Danny Dark, who was for 15 years the voice of NBC and did promos there. I did promos for 10 years there. But Danny was the primary voice. He did most of the stuff. He had $1 million contract for 15 years. He had one voice. That's all. He was the voice of Superman on the Hanna-Barbera Super Friends. He was the guy that said, when the world needs a better idea, Ford puts it on wheels. or no cat ever walked away from Frisky's buffet. And I mean, the guy had a half a dozen great accounts that made him a lot of money, in addition to the NBC account, which was a $15 million account. One voice. But he had one guy who liked him. And that one guy, well, actually there were two, because there was a guy named Chuck Bloor who had a creative house who produced commercials. And he heard the purity of Danny's voice, and he nurtured Danny as a commercial announcer. And Danny was easily malleable at that time. He had coming out of radio. And so, but these guys loved him, loved his work, and furthered his career.
You have to be good at reading cold copy.
You know, when I was in high school, that was back in the 40s. They didn't know what dyslexia was in those days. But I was dyslexic. And so I got put into what we called the bunkhead English class. It was for people with lousy reading and comprehension skills. And in that class, I was the slowest of the slow. And it manifested itself this way. They'd say, okay, everybody read this chapter. And so we'd sit there reading the chapter, and I would read, the man put his hat, no, his head. And I'd look at him, what? The man put his hat, no, his head? And I'd read it again. And he's turning pages. The man put his hat on his, oh, on, switch. And so now I'm behind, and I'm reading another couple of paragraphs, and everybody's turning pages, and I'm still on page one. So I was the slowest of the slow. I was the worst bonehead English class person at all. So isn't it ironic that years later I get into an occupation, being a disc jockey, where I had to read cold copy. And I had, at that time, several different little comments that I'd make when I screwed up a piece of copy. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, this has been brought to you by a lull in Jack Angel's brain. Or, you know, I'm sorry, my tongue got in the way of my eye tooth and I couldn't see what I was saying. Or, you know, just a whole bunch of really crazy crap like that, which endeared me to some, and somebody else thought, man, it's a big fake. Whatever, it didn't matter, because I had a great time doing it, whether they liked it or not. But you create something that helps you get out of the jam you put yourself in.
If one of our listeners wanted to do voiceover, where would they start?
Well, there are, I'm going to show you something. This is the voiceover reference guide. The voiceover reference guide. This is produced by some guys here in LA. They also have an online presence. www.voiceoverresourceguide.com. You go there, and in this book or online, they have recording studios, agents, talent managers, casting services, and people who teach. I taught for a while. It was so frustrating, I stopped. There were some people that were brilliant and some people that were never going to get it. Never. And I didn't want to take their money. And most of the guys that teach, they don't care. They'll take the money and they charge them twice. They say, no, come back for a second go around at it. Because they're in the game of making money from teaching classes. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to make money from teaching classes. I didn't do it for free, but I didn't want to, that wasn't my goal, to make a whole bunch of money from it. I thought it would be kind of fun to do it and make a little money in the process. And I had a little studio here in North Hollywood, but it became so frustrating to me because I couldn't, no matter, I didn't have the skills to be able to pull it out of them, you know, and I can hear what you say, and if you say, the man had put his hat on his head, I can say, the man put his hat on his head. But they would say, the man put his hat on his head. I said, no, put his hat on his head. The man put his hat on his head. And they don't have the ear for it. And then we'd get some of the guys would come in and say, I will ask you a question. I said, no, it's not ask, it's ask. And I didn't have time to do an English class, you know, in addition to teaching, doing the voiceover class. And it just got frustrating.
So, Jack, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
I found that recently, because I've been doing this for so long, that I'm pretty much, of doing voiceovers, pretty much the master of what I do, you know? And I can almost phone it in most of the time. The copywriters are terrible these days, some of them. And we're doing junk a lot of the time. Not all the time. Some of it's brilliant, but there's a lot of just the junk. I find that sometimes I get the attitude that I'm just throwing it away. Like, yeah, this is good enough. And you know that old story about the guy that was marooned on his house in a flood, and a boat came, and he said, "No, God will save me," and they went away. And another boat came. "No, God will save me," and the water keeps rising. Pretty soon, the water's up to his neck, and the boat comes, and he says, "God will save me," and he drowned. And he gets up to heaven, and he says, "God, why didn't you save me?" And God says, "I sent the boat three times." Well, I just recently said to my wife, I've been sending the boat away. A piece of copy comes in, and I'm just giving it lip service sometimes. And I had to retrain my attitude that this is not junk. This is the boat. And, you know, one thing leads to the next thing leads to the next. And if you throw away that one, you don't get a shot at the one that follows. And even though I have this charmed life and I don't really have to work, I'm still doing it. So if I'm going to do it, I should do it right. And so I'm now calling all of them the boat.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Well, part of it's going to Malibu. Part of it is I have the most phenomenal wife a man could ever ask for. And she's a soothing influence.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say?
Well, here's what I would say. I'd ask them, what components have to exist for something to be real? Is this real because I can feel it? Because it has shape and substance, and you can drink coffee out of it? Even though it's cold? Or is that how you would define something that's real? It has substance. You can see it. You can feel it. You can hear it. And then I would say, okay, the taste of licorice, the taste, not the licorice, the taste of licorice. You don't know what licorice tastes like until you taste it, and then you know licorice, and you cannot tell me licorice and have me know licorice. I have to taste it for myself. I can't tell you orgasm. You have to have an orgasm before you know what it is. I can't tell it to you and have you know it. Once you experience it, you know it forever. But you can't reach in and get a handful of orgasm and package it over here. It has no substance. So the stuff that becomes real is the stuff that has no substance. So what's all the stuff that has the substance? That's all the illusion. It's all atoms. If you could spread it out, big, 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 put your hand through it. But you can't do that. But that's, you know, we've seen examples of it. It's just atoms all whirling around, jammed together, making coffee cups and making you and me and microphones and paper and all that stuff. So that's the illusion. That's the game we're in. The real stuff, like a rock is just a rock. But if you pound it into a coin out of that silver rock, that becomes money. But that's just a game. Yeah, it's just a rock. People will kill you for all those little rocks. They don't get it. That it's just a game. The games are made so that if you follow the rules, you can win. But if you cheat, you lose. And so does everybody else in the game. So since life is that kind of a game, play the game. Play it to the hilt. But it's a game. Have fun. If you kill somebody in the game, you've ruined it. It's better to try to beat that person in the game fairly, because that's an accomplishment. But then there are people with twisted minds who would rather kill you to get you out of the way so we don't have to compete against you. And we can amass all the stupid little rocks in a big pile, you know, and to do what?
I want to thank Jack Angel for joining me today. Thanks, Jack. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.